Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Now try to picture this. You walk into a room. Six people are there already. Five men, one woman. You sit down. They start talking, telling you the stories of their lives. They take turns speaking, interrupting each other, picking up the pieces of those stories that at times you're not sure where to look, who to listen to. Then they're finished. It's the sort of experience you would normally dread. Which one was that one? Who was it in Florida? And who's the guy from Texas? Well, while a new play called The Exonerated is sort of like that, the difference is that you leave the theater with each single story tattooed on your brain. That's because each one of the stories tells you the first-person account of what it is like to be wrongly accused of a crime, what it is like to be sentenced to death, to live on death row, and then, years later, to walk free, exonerated. These are stories that sit like cold stones in your stomach. Connection listeners, for years, the death penalty has revolved around the morality and the efficacy of the punishment. But today, the stories of those wrongfully accused is changing the debate. We see it up on the stage, and we see it in states like Illinois. Are you changing your mind about the death penalty? And what do the stories of the wrongfully accused have to tell us about crime and that ultimate punishment? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. With me today, two people who researched and wrote the play, The Exonerated. Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen are a husband and wife team. They're also both actors and producers. Welcome to The Connection.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
And also with us, Carrie Max Cook. Carrie's one of the men whose story is highlighted in The Exonerated. He was wrongfully convicted and spent 22 years on death row in Texas. He was released 3.5 years ago, and he's in the studio. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, nice to have you here. I'm going to start with the writers, because they're the ones who bring us together. And, Jessica and Eric, you started with, what, 89-some-odd stories, whittled it down to 40, 20. How did that process work?
Well, Jessica's smarter than I am, so why doesn't she take the first question?
Well, at the time we got the idea for the play, there were 89 people who had been exonerated from death row since the reinstatement of the death penalty in the 70s. There are now 102. Of that 89, once we started doing research, we were able to track down about 40 of them. And we called all of those 40 on the phone, cold called them. We were so nervous. Hi, we're two actors from New York. We're writing a play.
And they're like, you want to do what about what?
And we did initial interviews with those 40 people. A few people said, you know, I haven't been able to move out of the town where I was convicted. I've really had enough attention. I can't stand it anymore. There's too much stigma already. You know, I'd rather not. But most people were pretty receptive. And from those 40, we went to speak in person to the 20 of them whose stories were most compelling, who were most articulate, who most wanted to be public with their voices and also seemed most engaged with the idea of the play.
And also who most represented the issue. You know, we wanted to make sure that we spoke to women. We wanted to make sure that we spoke to white men, black men. And it was very important to sort of approach the issue in totality, not just, you know, in little sections.
So we went to speak to about 20 people. We traveled around the country in the summer of 2000. And from those interviews, the initial draft of the play that was had three benefit readings plus one at the United Nations in the fall of 2000 with a bunch of really wonderful actors, Susan Sarandon, Tim Robbins, Richard Dreyfuss, Charles Dutton, Ossie Davis. Lots of great people did those readings. That version of the play had 12 stories in it. And the text of that version was taken entirely from the interviews that we had done with those 12 people. And the benefit readings went really well. People were very affected. But the one question that kept coming back to us over and over again was, how did this happen? People would come up to us and they'd say, I understand what happened and I understand how these people felt about what happened to them, but I don't understand how with the system that we have, something like this could go so wrong.
So in conjunction with Bob Balaban, who produced Gosford Park, and if you've ever seen a movie, Bob's probably in it. he was an old friend of mine. He directed me a play at MTC in New York. We decided with him that we would go into court transcripts, and we went into probably 40 or 50,000 pages of court transcripts. You know, six cases, that's a lot of pages. I mean, Kerry's reviewed his own case. Kerry will tell you how many pages even a single case is. So we went into those, and we went into dusty old record files down in Florida. People thought we were law students, and we didn't do anything to contradict that. then we just assembled it together. I've likened it to mixing electronic music. It's like sort of like sampling. You're taking
you
people's
use
words.
Only the words.
Yep.
Of the people that you interviewed, mm-hmm. and only the words that come directly from the transcripts,
or from letters.
But yeah. That's how you
that was how we limited ourselves. Everything had to have been actually said by the participants in these cases, and we had to cut the number of stories down to six in the play in order to fully tell each of them in 90 minutes. There was just no way to have more than that, and we really tried to pick the ones that were most representative, not only of geography, socioeconomic class, race, and all of those kinds of things, but also of how people deal with this experience, how they come through it, what kinds of family situations they had. And we also were very careful to choose people, at least a few people, who also were family members of murder victims. Gary Gauger's parents were murdered. He actually was on death row wrongly for their murder.
Right.
Carrie's brother was murdered, and Sonny's husband, Jesse, who later turned out to be innocent, was wrongfully executed. So we really wanted to kind of try to close the gap between the accused and family members of murder victims.
Let me ask Carrie, what you've been out of jail, what, maybe a year or so when these folks approached you? What was your first reaction? Hey, we want to write a play about you, your story, your life.
I'd already been traveling quite a bit trying to give the death penalty a face. When they came to Plano, Texas to meet with me, it was difficult. Nowhere in the entire world is my story, 12 minutes of it, told so graphically, in your face, and so honestly. I had to get to know him quite well because I had to relive my brother's murder, which I wasn't willing to do publicly at that point.
This has been mentioned a couple of times. We should talk about this. You're already in jail, falsely, wrongly accused of murdering a young woman.
DNA evidence ultimately exonerated Kerry.
And while you're in jail, you're being beaten up, you're having, like, about as unimaginably a bad time as you can have, given the fact that you're already on death row, right?
Right, yes.
And then your brother comes into the story. Tell us how his story then intersects with yours.
I'm going to try to keep it brief, if I can. There's no way to really keep it brief, but I'll try. First of all, my brother and I, he was 2 years older than me. We shared a very close bond together. My father was a career military man, born and raised in Europe, lived off the army post, so no one spoke English. So my brother and I, that certainly contributed to how we got to be so close. And Texas death row is not like the death rows on, no death row is a joyride, but Texas is a little more austere. It was a 5x9 cell, no books, no... not allowed to have basically anything except pain and heartache. And mail came like five days a week. And I lived for the day, those hours when my brother would write me a letter and stay in contact with me, because you can't see, feel, or touch anything on Texas death row except the other death row inmates. So I watched my brother evolve and in some cases devolve into... drinking and so forth, and the letters got few and farther between. And then there was the stunning phone call 10, 12 years later where I was called to the chaplain's office, and I thought it was going to be my brother, because you knew on Texas death row, whenever the chaplain paid you a visit, it was a harbinger of death, that they don't come to check your soul. They just come to bring you the news of a death in the family. I was lucky to avoid those meetings with the chaplain for a long time. But when they started coming, they all came at once, my father and my brother, everything. My brother
Do you want me to pick
sure.
up for a second? Carrie's brother was ultimately, he'd started off as a businessman, and because of Carrie's experience, what happened to Carrie, I can't speak for Carrie's brother, and I would never deign to, but that contributed to his drinking and his a lifestyle change, and eventually ended up working at a McDonald's. And one night, him and a friend went to a bar. And at the bar, they got into an argument with somebody. Carrie's brother was a real peacemaker and tried to, smooth things over. They went out to the parking lot. It was winter. The locks were frozen in the car. And a gentleman, I wouldn't call him a gentleman, got out of his truck. And it was the person that they'd had the argument with in the bar. And he shot Carrie's brother point blank in a parking lot and killed him right there. And the guy who shot Carrie's brother because the DA was reluctant to bring it to trial since Carrie was on death row. They'd say that Carrie's brother had bragged that he had a brother on death row and he was tough. And the guy who killed Carrie's brother point blank in front of 20 witnesses in a parking lot got 10 years and was out in 3.
And when that story is told in the play, The Exonerated, by the actor who is reading lines that you have spoken, there's a point at which I don't know whether to say the actor, you, Carrie, that character, makes the point that then there you are on death row and your mother blames you for your brother's death.
Yes, when I first got out, I literally crawled out of a death row in Texas. The Human Rights Watch report released a study last year. It was on World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, said that I was one of the most brutalized men in America in prison. So I literally crawled out of prison, and here I was trying to rekindle some semblance of what I'd lost, and my mother was just not there, and I didn't understand, and there was such resentment, and I didn't understand the resentment. I was just innocent and wanted my mother back. Basically blamed me not only for the murder, but being forced, as Eric so eloquently restates in the play, being forced to make the deal to give the man so he could get out in 3 years. And so 4 years later, what's not in the play is my father died of cancer, and I was still on death row. Well, in that same setting where I had finally left East Texas, my mom told me that I'd basically killed my brother. And although my father died of cancer, that he basically died of a broken heart, too. So I killed him as well. And that they had lost everything, their restaurants, everything they had, they cherished in that small East Texas town. So those things have been very difficult to deal with and to speak with Eric and Jessica about 2 years ago.
And the thing that makes me, other than the human tragedy that Carrie has undergone, the thing that makes me really angry, And this play was written because I couldn't scream at the newspaper anymore. My wife has different reasons for writing it. But this play was really the only thing that could contain my fury at A, the people who did this to Carrie, and B, the people who do this on a regular basis. It happens a lot more than people want to admit to. And doing it wrong doesn't make us any safer.
The name of the play is The Exonerated. For people in the Boston area, it's at the Wilbur Theater. We'll be traveling later to Chicago. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're interested in hearing from you about whether or not you see, ultimately, the debate in this country over capital punishment changing. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio this hour, playwrights Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen. Their play, The Exonerated, is gathering critical attention and awards. It focuses specifically on those people who get off death row, people who should never have been there in the first place. And also in the studio with us, Carrie Max Cook, who spent 22 years wrongfully accused in a cell on death row in Texas. And Jessica, what was it about Carrie's story that had you two zero in and say, this needs to be told?
Well, When we were on the road interviewing 20 exonerated death row inmates, we actually interviewed Kerry last. He was the last person we met, and we thought we had heard everything. We had been in and out of people's houses all over the country. We thought we had heard it all, and then we walked into Kerry's living room, and we're just, it was all like it was the first time. He said it before, he's been through probably more than just about anybody else in the prison system in America.
Give us a précis of what he told you.
Well, in terms of his case, what he told us was that in the 70s, he was 19 years old. He was living at an apartment complex in Tyler, Texas. And there was a young woman there named Linda Jo Edwards. And they met by the swimming pool, hung out a little bit. She invited him back to her room.
It was the 70s. Yeah.
They spent a little time there, and then he left. And that was all he heard from her ever again until 3 months later he was arrested for her murder based on a fingerprint that the investigators had found on her door frame that he had left when he was in his apartment 3 months later. The prosecution had a quote-unquote fingerprint expert at the trial who claimed that he could date that fingerprint to the time of the murder. Well, it's scientifically impossible to date a fingerprint. You can't do that, but that was admitted into evidence and seemed pretty damning for Kerry. The backstory is that Linda, the victim, had been having an affair with a professor over at the university, a married professor in his 40s. He had a family. And he had broken up with her. She attempted suicide. And the affair came into the public eye. And he was fired from his job. He lost his family. It was a really devastating thing for him. And they had a series of conflicts that culminated in her saying to several people around around her in their social circle that she was really getting afraid of him, that his behavior was becoming very erratic. And Linda's roommate, Paula, actually saw him in their apartment the night of the murder. In her police report, she gave a full description of who she saw, and she said it was clearly it was
this
him.
This guy, yeah.
And that evidence was not admitted into trial until Kerry's fourth trial? Is that right? Until he had been on death row for over 20 years. This evidence that, you know, that there had been evidence from the very beginning of who really looked like the real murderer, they never went after him.
For example, she said that the figure that she saw had silver hair cut above the ears, medium length, touching the ears fashion, had white tennis shorts, and also was approximately her height, which was about 5'8". And she, in her sworn statement, she goes on to identify Mayfield. And one of the witnesses that testified before the grand jury had heard this, some of this press, and gave the district attorney's office, A.D. Clark, a photo of me taken at the Holiday Club in Port Arthur, Texas, where I was working as a bartender subsequently. And they saw the picture. My hair was long, brown to my shoulders, and he clearly remembers giving it to him, and they just suppressed it and took me to trial a year later. And basically, my defense cost $500. My parents.
You had a court-appointed lawyer, or you had?
No, my parents paid him $500.
And he'd never tried a death penalty case before.
No, they'd never. No. The death penalty was just coming on the American landscape at this point. Shortly thereafter, I remember this like it was yesterday. The very first execution of Gary Gilmore. It was 1977, January of 1977. I remember that and bringing the death penalty back to America. But anyway, it was my legal odyssey with Texas is said to be the worst case of police and prosecutorial misconduct in Texas history. That's how it happens.
And as you have spent time in the years while you were on death row and since then looking at other people who've gone through similar things, do you consider what happened to you just some horrible, bad collection of things that went wrong, or does it happen way more often than that?
Well, the one thing that exonerated Kerry ultimately was DNA evidence.
Right.
And DNA evidence in a lot only accounts for about 8% of the exonerations in the United States. There are a lot of other things that go on other than DNA. It's not a panacea. You know, it's not the silver bullet that...
There are a lot of cases that don't involve DNA evidence. So it's actually quite lucky that there was DNA evidence in this case that proved without a doubt that he wasn't the one who did it.
You'd still be there without that.
Yeah.
And to be able to answer your question, as I say, the audience is, when I'm introduced, our freedom, certainly the five other stories that Eric and Jessica bring to the theater, of the 102, we're not freed from the criminal justice system recognizing its mistake, correcting it. We're free through outside intervention, such as my freedom came from the Princeton, New Jersey nonprofit group Centurion Ministries. They're not a ministry, but they're a nonprofit group that investigates wrongful convictions. And if the evidence is there that you're innocent, they do private donations. They fund a lawyer and so forth. Gary Gauger was freed through Larry Marshall Center for Wrongful Conviction. Everyone has their own story. In some cases, it's simply a gumshoe reporter who breaks the story.
I mean, what does it say about our system when a bunch of college students can get somebody off death row?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that's really, I mean, bravo for them. They're my heroes. But, I mean, that's really, in Gary Gauger's case, it was Larry Marshall and a number of college students who helped get him out.
In Sonny Jacobs' case, it was a high school friend of hers named Mickey Dickoff who made a movie about her case and brought public attention. Everybody was freed only because of special circumstances.
Absolutely.
And did anybody ever say they were sorry?
No, they never do, but... The play has been cathartic for me in many different areas. First, like I said, there's nowhere in the world my story is said told so graphically. But there's been some amazing people that come to see the play. I had the district attorney of Brooklyn walk up to me and say, with tears in her eyes, and on behalf of America, I'd like to give you the apology you never got. Current prosecutors will come that have come to
well,
see
Janet,
the play.
Janet Reno talked to you too, right?
Yes, I spoke with Janet Reno a few days ago in Washington, D.C. after the performance of The Exonerated. She was there for a conference, and she thought she'd stop in and see the play, and so she joined the fundraiser I was speaking at later, and she stood up on the podium. You could tell that she was discombobulated. She was lost for words, and she looked at me, and she looked out at the audience and said, "This play was the most incredible thing she'd ever seen in her life. I just wish she would have saw it 2 years ago when she was still Attorney General."
We actually have a number of people in our audience who'd like to get in on this conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'll start in Warren, Wisconsin. Joe is on the line. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Hey, I'm from Minnesota. How's the weather out there?
It's not very nice, really.
Right on.
It's about 10 degrees at best. I'd have a question for Carrie first, and that is what reparations were made to you by the government, and then a question for the playwrights. How much money have you folks made from these plays and these victims, and where does that money go?
First of all, I received nothing from the state of Texas. In fact, I'm precluded from suing the state of Texas in order to get compensation. It's the way the laws are set up.
And then to answer the second part of your question,
a large portion of what the play makes goes to the exonerated people. We also collect money for them at the end of the night. And Jessica and I, we sort of figured out the math. We worked on this for free for, I don't know, about almost 3 years. And we've gotten about 12 cents an hour.
But as soon as our royalties begin coming in, we and also everybody else involved in producing the play.
And everybody whose story is in the play.
Is giving a percentage to the people whose stories are in the play. And like Eric said, every night we also collect money from the audience that goes directly to the six people whose stories are featured in the play, and they get regular weekly checks from
that. And I'd like to say, if I could, everyone associated with this project, every actor, the rotating cast, all the way down to who answers the phones for the Culture Project, all the way up to Alan Bushman, the owner of the theater, and Bob Balaban, their director, and these writers, they're phenomenal people. They feel so much what has happened to innocent. I mean, innocent people. They've seen the play many, many times, over and over and over, and I don't believe it's about money. I don't think the bottom line here is money. I think the bottom line, even to these people, especially these two at the table sitting with me, is justice. I really feel that each and every night that I've been a part of this project. And I know of at least one person, the story of Delbert Tibbs, the six on stage have gotten no remuneration. And Delbert Tibbs...
From the state.
From the state, yes. Delbert Tibbs was so poor he couldn't even put a phone line in. But thanks to these people, he has just a little bit more than he had before this play came about.
All right. Joe, I hope that answers your question. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Beverly Farms, Massachusetts, Miriam's on the line. Hi, Miriam.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Eric and Jessica. It's Miriam. I was very privileged to be part of the cast on one of the first nights.
Hi.
Is this Miriam Sear?
Yes.
Hey,
sir.
How you doing, Miriam?
How are you?
All right. I'm a mom. I'm about to pick up my little girl.
Wow. Congratulations.
I just wanted to say that I had the privilege to meet Carrie, to meet all of the exonerated people that night who had come to attend this reading, and that what was the most, there were so many striking moments in that whole evening.
Miriam, but, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
As an actor who has to take the words of these people and read them, say them on the stage, is that different from other roles you've had?
Yes. It's completely different because you feel a huge sense of responsibility and a huge sense of you forget yourself completely only to the benefit of what is being said, and it is truer in this instance than in any other production I've ever been in. Also, because the way it's set up, it is only about the words and the story, and it is not about lighting or cues or people coming in and out of stage. And this is what makes it such a powerful event, because people come to hear lives, and what is conjured up is beyond anything a normal theatrical experience can normally provide. So it was very thrilling, of course, as an actor, but it was mostly a huge sense of responsibility and privilege. But what I wanted to say was that what is so striking is that all of these people, Carrie included, who I remember so vividly, is how at peace they are with these horrific things that have been done to them, and what greater human beings they are for it, in this immense sense of resilience that you feel and that you just are awed by. And I cannot recommend more that people go and see this, because so many people walked in there, real harsh, you know, and hard believers in the death row penalty, seeing their worlds of opinions completely blown away and transformed.
Miriam, let me pick it up from there if I can, because you've put your finger right on something that I was turning over in my mind, and you've said it better than I could. How is it, Carrie, that you have this 22 years of your life that was in effect stolen from you, and yet you do have this sense of coming to terms with that, being at peace with that? I'd still be breaking windows. I'd be so angry.
I won't say at peace with it. I will say this: one of the things that stands out about my story, wherever I go, whatever venue I'm in, is the fact that you don't hear the bitterness, the anger. The reason being is because I understand the death penalty so well. I understand Texas politics so well that I know to be in this room, as whomever the actor is playing me says, it's such an extraordinary cost to be here. You have no idea. I know it's a miracle to be here. The state of Texas took 22 years from me. What good would life be if I can't come out here and be a beacon for innocent people, if I can't dedicate the rest of my life to helping them and giving this issue more of a face? There's no room for bitterness or angerness.
Boy, though, Jessica, Eric, it's so much more than a face. There's dignity. There is, you know, in the story that you tell, as well as in Carrie's story, just unbelievable.
That's been the most amazing gift to us in the whole process of doing this play and seeing it go out in the world and seeing these incredible actors and this incredible director take it on. the biggest gift for us has been to be able to encounter these extraordinary human beings. They're like nobody else I've ever met in my life, and I've learned so much from them.
Ditto. I mean, it's a penance for me. It's a penance for being a selfish actor for 10 years. I mean, that's really what we do. I'm a reluctant and accidental playwright, and I don't think I'm any great shakes. I mean, part of that is just me being from the Midwest, and we don't do that there. But, you know, Jessica and I often talk about being a conduit for something greater than us. There's something going on here. There's something greater that we were privileged to be a channel for. And I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's the universe. I don't know if it's God. I don't know if it's something more compelling than that. but it really... it's really a privilege to have worked on this.
And the reason they got these 12 stories, they got these five other people to sit down with them and pour out their heart and soul, which comes through each and every story in the theater, is because these are two extraordinary human beings. They felt from the beginning of when they saw that at Columbia University, it struck a chord within them, and they thought, how could this happen? How could this be going on? And they sought out to travel around and find out how it was going on, hear the stories, what they brought back, you're seeing in the theater.
And you know, that being said, you know, we're not telling anybody what to think. You know, we're not being didactic. You know, obviously, you can probably tell just from hearing us that what our views on the death penalty are. We decided early on that we weren't going to preach to anybody, that we weren't going to preach to anyone, that we would let the stories speak for themselves and people could walk out with their own reaction.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about the play The Exonerated, the death penalty in America. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're going straight back to the lines. Madison, Wisconsin. Jeff's joining us. Hello, Jeff.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I was a prisoner's advocate for a little over 6 years in the 70s and 80s. And Wisconsin doesn't have a death penalty, but I personally, under my jacket, came out of the state prison in Waupun with appeals paper for a man who had 29 years of service to a life sentence, which was she's tried in Green Bay, Brown County, for a murder that did not occur in Brown County, and a jailhouse prisoner saw it. So all the indications are that the railroad runs through every state and that the kangaroo lurks in all the courts. And several times today, actors, activists said privilege. And it was my privilege to represent these folks because a lot of them simply didn't do it. And Sylvester Smith is the guy I'm talking about who sat for 29 years who never had a trial, a legal trial. And I worked with other lifers and got other lifers out. And I was a rank amateur. So even 25 years ago, the system was terribly corrupt.
Jeff, let me ask you if you think things are changing. I mean, we
for
know...
For the worse.
For the worse.
For the worse.
Why do you
Except
say that?
For the death penalty, the kangaroo still sits there, and people are put away who are given choices by prosecutors like, well, if you cop to this, you'll sit for 3 years. If you force us into a trial, we're going to get 20 or 30 out of you. And what do you think you're going to say if you're poor and you're not white and you're sitting there with a public defender? You're going to say, well, 3 years against the chance that I'll sit there for the next 30 or more. I mean, it's totally out of hand. You have to look on balance that we now have as many prisoners in prisons and jails in the United States as Stalin had in the Gulag, if you trust Solzhenitsyn's testimony and Milovan Gilas's testimony. This is a really messy business. We talk about the prison industrial complex, and it's got nothing to do with any kind of justice. It's just a machine.
Jeff, I had a few statistics here that last year there were 71 people executed in the United States. That's up from the year before and near the high over the past 25 years. There have already been 3 people put to death this year. And maybe it's useful to ask the people in the room here whether or not you see or hear or get a sense that the larger debate is changing in any way. Jeff's got kind of a depressing view of it. Do you share that?
Well, what I think is, I think that what he says is saying about the actual prison system and wrongful conviction changing for the worse may be correct. I think, you know, I could go on about that. The war on drugs has greatly increased the number of people, and including innocent people in America's prisons, the privatization of prisons. There are a lot of problems around that. But I do think that the debate around the death penalty itself is shifting because of this very issue of innocence. I think when you stay in the moral debate about, well, I believe it's right, well, I believe it's wrong.
It's a deterrent.
It gets polarized. And the two sides stay in opposition and can never find any middle ground to actually have a conversation. And I think this issue of innocence is something that even people who are pro-death penalty are often concerned about. For example, Governor Ryan in Illinois was a Republican who was for the death penalty before he found out how many wrongful convictions were actually occurring in Illinois.
In a given year, there were at one point 13 exonerations and 12 executions in Illinois. Those kind of odds we wouldn't allow. Tire companies, we wouldn't allow those kind of odds if a space shuttle went up. We wouldn't allow those kinds of odds if we were doing a military action. Why don't we expect better odds from our prison system?
He saw the play, didn't he, Governor Ryan?
Yeah,
before he made his decision.
A few weeks ago in Chicago.
Jessica was at the conference. It was pretty incredible. They invited around 40 exonerated people from all over the country to come see it.
The Center for Wrongful Convictions.
Yeah, the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University organized a performance of the play for several members of the Illinois State Legislature, over 40 exonerated death row inmates, and Governor Ryan.
And the question of whether it's getting worse or not, I mean, you know, it sort of comes down to a question of who we want to be. If we want to be a beacon of democracy for people in the world, we have something called the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And as pieces of paper and when well practiced, those are beautiful documents. Those are the soul of our country. In most of these cases, those documents weren't adhered to.
And in fact, were trampled on.
And it's really a question of who do we want to be.
You know, I look at you know, the websites that tell us what's going on with capital punishment in the country, and sure enough, today in Texas, a fellow by the name of Robert Looking Bill is scheduled to be executed. He's convicted of bludgeoning his grandmother to death, robbing her. He's been in 7 years. He says he's innocent. Do you know?
Not intimately. I was on the same wing with Robert Looking Bill at a time or two on the work program before it was abolished.
Because this stuff still goes on. I mean, on one hand, you've got most people on, or not most, I don't know this, but you have a lot of people on death row who say they're innocent, and some are. And that's a funny place for people who are on the outside looking in to try and make sense of that. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I'll put it to you like this. After my experience on Texas death row, when I hear someone say they're innocent, it makes me think twice, because I know how easy it is to be railroaded to death row with your only crime at times being poor. I was quite stunned about a year and a half ago when I was working within the 77th Texas legislature to try to bring about a moratorium on the death penalty, sponsored by Representative Harold Dutton. And they came out with a poll, whether it's a Gallup or whatever, just some poll. Dallas Morning News may have done it. And I was stunned by this, that 65% of those polled believe that we had executed innocent people in Texas. This is from Texas, the capital of capital punishment. So I thought, after having seen that poll, that things were shifting, things were turning, that all by itself was going to make such a change. But it seems like on the war on crime, those who support capital punishment are also willing to support the collateral damage of the innocent people.
Look, you know, like, I'm not sitting here with a guitar. Actually, I do have a guitar, but I'm not sitting here playing Kumbaya. You know, I mean, like, look, I'm really realistic. If anybody did anything to my wife, I'd want them to go to jail forever. And it's just because of the systemic problems that exist. My personal belief, and this isn't in the play, this didactic sort of behavior isn't in the play. It's just me talking on the radio here. Come see the play if you want to see what the play's about. But you know, I'm a big believer in life in prison without the absolute possibility of parole. Absolutely. You know, I think that there are people that society needs to be protected from. But, you know, there are also people, like Carrie, who need to be protected from a broken system. And there's the rub, isn't it?
And can the system be fixed? Is what's wrong with the system something that can be fixed?
No, it can't be fixed. The Innocence Protection Act of 2000, Senator Lay, good intentions, but that won't fix it. It's a human-operated system, man-made system. It's going to make mistakes because we have egos involved. I don't believe there's a single case of the 102 that's without police and prosecutorial misconduct. These are not innocent mistakes being made. This is the ends justify the means.
And people are human beings will be human beings. The possibility of error will always exist. And that's why life in prison without the possibility of parole is a good solution for dealing with the most heinous kinds of crimes, because that's always reversible. If it's found that mistakes were made, you can always reverse it. You can't reverse death.
Let's go back to the calls. Bud's joining us from Boston. Hi, Bud.
Hi, how are you?
Fine,
I was honored to see the play last night. I actually live in Oklahoma City. I happen to be in Boston this weekend for a board meeting. I'm on the board of directors of Murder Victims' Families for Reconciliation, and we're a group of about 3,000 nationwide that try to abolish the death penalty. And my only daughter was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. And I think Carrie and I actually met in Texas a couple of years ago. And I think it was in Austin, if I recall.
Bud, you're an incredibly brave man, and you're one of my heroes. I wish I could have met you last night.
Well, I certainly saw you. I was sitting in about the fourth row, and Carrie, I thought the play was so powerful. And I think the thing that I always say, I actually spoke at the School of Law over at Harvard yesterday afternoon, and I think that the most important thing about the death penalty is we only kill the easy ones in this country, and by that I mean the poor ones. We have about 112 on death row at McAllister, Oklahoma at this moment, and not a single one had the money to pay for their own defense and their appeals. There were about five or six that had the money to hire a cheap lawyer, but no appeal money. And it's the same story over and over again. I made about 14 trips to Illinois over the last 4 years over the, you know, trying to get a moratorium there, and we were finally successful. And you asked the question, I think, a bit ago about can the death penalty be fixed? The Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court said on the afternoon of January the 31st of 2001, when asked the question by a Chicago Tribune reporter, can the death penalty be fixed, Chief Justice Harrison simply said, no, it can't, because man is fallible. And we just must abolish the death penalty. And Carrie, it was so wonderful to see you last night.
Thank you, Bud. It's nice to. I'm glad you called in. I've heard of you for a long time, and I think we did meet. I think it was the 77th legislature in Texas.
I think, but I'm not sure of that. Yeah.
I'm glad you called in. I wish, like Eric, I could have met you last night.
Bud, thanks a lot for your call. Nice to have you on the program. There's a moment in the presentation of the play which nobody expects, and that is that it is a play. You go and you sit in a theater, and people talk to you. And then it's over, and people clap, and a lot of people stand up because they're moved. And then, as happened last night, and I gather happens in a lot of productions, you, Carrie, go up on stage. There's a real sort of second punch to the audience in reminding us all that what we just watched...
The reality just took the stage.
Yeah. What's that like for you? You've been up on the stage a few times.
Yes. It's it's a powerful point of the play because they hear these stories, but still, there's part of them knows that these are actors and actresses performing these people. And then when they say we have a special guest here, Carrie Mack, so you can actually hear the audience go, and they're shocked when I walk out there because they don't know what to expect, but they're just shocked. And it's been cathartic for me. I was reluctant to discuss what had happened to me in prison in such grave detail as I did with Eric and Jessica. So when I go up on the stage, there's that actual punch for me too. There's that overwhelming embarrassment because my character speaks of being raped in Texas prison and having things graffiti carved on my backside. So there's that initial moment. I think it's probably mutual where they're stunned for this reason. I'm a little initially stunned for that, but it's good. It's good to be able to show the audience that here's the faces of the death penalty and here's the reality of it standing on stage.
And when you walk down the street after a play on your way to the play and there's all these other people on the street, do you stand on the sidewalk there and go, you just have no idea, not about who I am, but about, you know, the liberty that you have to be on the sidewalk right now?
Yes, I'm stunned every second, every moment of the day. I'm just really happy to be here. Walking down the streets of New York, I finally understand all the logo and commercials from Death Row. I love New York. I love New York City. It's a beautiful place. And I'm fortunate through a lady who, a philanthropist, gave me 6 months living in New York City. It's probably the greatest gift outside of my freedom and my son I've ever had.
Well, we're real fortunate to have had you here on the program with us this hour. Thanks for
I'm
coming
I'm very
in.
Pleased to be here and Eric. Make the connection.
Thank you for having us here. We really appreciate it.
Connection listeners in the Boston area, The Exonerated runs at the Wilbur Theater through February the 2nd. The play is still running at the Bleecker Street Theater in New York City. Listeners in the Chicago area, you can see the play from the 4th of February until the 16th in that city. And we'll have a link on our webpage at theconnection.org to the publicity people so you can find out more about the play. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR.